The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Len Roberts. His most recent book is The Silent Singer. Here's Len.
I'd like to begin with this poem, Talking on the Telephone. 30 years later, I try to remember the telephone number back on Olmsted Street. See the black bass and receiver I took into the cold hallway those long winter nights. I talked to all the girls I loved. Inside the warm kitchen, my mother and father whispered. Now and then, the click of dishes set into the sink, the pop as the top snapped off another bottle of beer. But out there, it was wind drafting under the front door, finding its way up the stairs to where I would sleep. It was wind coming in from the back, too, down the long corridor with its one dim light. Hello, Mary. Hello, Suzanne, Dee Dee with the blue Angora sweater. How are you all tonight? I wish you were here. And then the drifter started to sing, Save the Last Dance for Me. My feet propped against the dark wallpaper, my nose and hands chilled, growing numb, while their voices flowed into my warm ear.
The voice of Len Roberts. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Len is a professor at Northampton College, and he has been doing this since 1974. He has 8 books out and 3 chapbooks of poetry and a new volume we're hearing today, The Silent Singer. These are new and selected poems from the University of Illinois. And Len is a person who was born in New York. I would say New York State, right?
Correct.
Okay. Cohoes, am I saying that?
Cohoes.
Right? Okay, Cohoes.
New York, yeah.
Attended Siena College, got his MA from Dayton, and his PhD in literature from Lehigh University. And the reason he's here is that I am on a quest in search of the narrative voice. And Len Roberts is the epitome of this, as far as I'm concerned, in how to tell a story. So what does that mean to you, Len, when I say a narrative poet? What do you think I mean by that?
Well, first of all, it's wonderful to hear you say that about my work, because one of the things I've always, one of the baseline requirements I've had for my poetry is that I can get up and read it and people can follow the plot, follow the line of it. So, and I like stories. I like poems that tell stories. But there's, I like to add one thing to that too. And when I try to write a narrative poem, I like to have one lyrical moment in it. One or two that would just lift the narrative up a little bit. Might be an image, might be a metaphor, might be a rift of music, but something that will lift it up and then bring it back to the narrative.
Would you show us where that was in that previous poem?
Yeah.
I think it's the blue Angora sweater. I mean, that blue Angora sweater is in my mind forevermore.
Well, thank you. Well, it is in mine too. Actually, in this poem, in Talking on the Telephone, the rift of music is, I think, where the poem lifts up a little bit. It's around line 6. Inside the warm kitchen, my mother and father whispered. Now and then the click of dishes set into the sink. The pop as the top snapped off another bottle of beer.
Yeah.
To me, that
that's
a little lyrical moment with the music carrying the language rather than the story.
And that is the difference between poetry and prose.
Yes.
And so we have the interior rhyme there. We have the cadence and the meter, and I'm really glad you pointed that out, because people think a narrative is, I was in the 5th grade and I saw this girl across the hall.
Exactly.
Yeah, from margin to margin, and it is really the lyrical tension inside of that that makes it work.
You need that. If, you know, Pound said that his greatest fear at the beginning of the century, when he really brought free verse into our country, he said his greatest fear was that poets would start writing prose, chopping it up into little lines and calling it poetry. And I think many poets do. And when you risk writing a narrative poem, that becomes even a worse risk.
That's interesting that you say when you risk a narrative, because often people feel that's the easiest poem to write.
It's the hardest thing to write and make it a poem, because you need something to lift it out of the narrative, out of the prosaic.
And if I could add to what I know of your work, it is not only do you tell a story that's indelible, that I never will forget, and bring back a time and people to life again from your own life, You always untangle a little human predicament. In every poem, there is a little predicament, a human frailty, a tiny failure you expose that really comes right to the heart.
Grace, you're really good. We think we know what we're doing, but we don't. But then after we do it, we look back, and then, at least in my life, I look back at my poems and I can figure out more or less what I've done. And many of my poems, almost all of them, are about people. And when you say people's failings, it's usually, for me, a question of a failing and then a redemption, or somehow grace attached to the failing. So when I write about my father's drinking, it's usually about him drinking as he's trying to educate me. There is that failing, you're right, that human weakness, which we all have, which I find to be the core of what we are. But then there's this little click of grace that comes with the failure.
Which you are going to show us right now.
Exactly.
From
I have
the book,
a poem.
The Silent Singer.
Thank you. This is a poem about my Aunt Eleanor. Now, my Aunt Eleanor is my mother's sister. And unfortunately, my mother's family, of the five sisters, four of them got Alzheimer's by the time they were 60. Now, my Aunt Eleanor left Cohoes. She went with a New England man up to Massachusetts, and she became very prim and proper. And my brother and I used to go up and visit her, and it was pretty boring. You know, I mean, we were up there in New England, and they were acting very prim and proper, and so were we. And forgive me for this, but until she got Alzheimer's. And when she got Alzheimer's, and I know it's a deadly disease, it's a terrible disease, but this woman became startlingly wonderful. So I thought I'd write a poem about how wonderful she became. And the title of the poem is the first line of the poem, and it comes from my mother calling me one night. And my mother, when she calls, she doesn't say, "How are you, Len?" She says, she gives me a line like, "Your Uncle Joey broke his leg," or, so this is one of her lines, and it's a poem about my Aunt Eleanor. My Uncle Chauncey drove my Aunt Eleanor. My Uncle Chauncey drove my Aunt Eleanor over 200 miles every day. Because she had Alzheimer's, could not remember where she was or where she had been, and had to see the elephants in the zoo again, stop in to see her friend Rose for the third day in a row. When they left the house, he had his teeth clenched deep in his jaw, but she was smiling, 16 again, bowing to swoop up the tall-stemmed tulips, oohing and aahing as she looked into the yellow and red, ripping the petals off in puffs of circus colors just before she skipped the rest of the way down the walk. Sometimes she'd call him Pete or William or some other man's name and hold his hand away she had never held his hand. And Chauncey would get jealous, although he was 62 and knew her mind was riddled with time, like the rotten oak log in his backyard the carpenter ants had eaten their way through. Holding the car door for her to slide in, he'd shout, "Who's Bill? And who in heck are Ray and Merrill? What have you been doing all these years?" But she'd just bend over to ask in that low, sweet voice that had so recently come back if he would please peel out the way he used to, leave smoldering tracks by the yellow curb in front of their house.
The mystery in that poem is the sweet voice that came back.
Yes.
That says so much, gives so much exposition in those, that tiny phrase.
The image. I love
the
image.
Well, you're the kingmaker of imagery.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you some of the books he's written. Cohoes Theater, From the Dark, Sweet Ones, Black Wings, Learning About the Heart, Dangerous Angels, The Million Branches, Counting the Black Angels, The Troublemaking Finch, and then we're talking about The Silent Singer. Len Roberts is his name. I am Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we are going to have some wonderful poetry today. We're talking to a guy who really is becoming, I think, America's greatest narrative poet. You know, I used to love another poet very much, Roland Flint, who just recently has died. And he carried forth this tradition because we need a progenitor. We need someone to show us how to do it. And how to maintain all the elements of poetry and still tell your story, because everyone has a story. How do you get yourself revved up spiritually to sit down and recall your aunt or to write a poem? What is the, how do you actually get a jump start on that spiritually? I mean, I know how the tools work.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's, to me, it's never a willed activity.
But don't you have to push yourself to do it, though?
Yes, I do. And when I write, there are things I do the night before or the few days before in order to prepare. And one of those things is to read poets I love, and I do love Roland Flint's work. I mean, he's a wonderful poet. Thank you for even putting me in his class. So I read poets I really love, and a few days before, I reread some poems that I might be working on revisions for, and then I wake up in the morning, and I hope when I get to the computer that an image or a rhythmical line will come. And if it does, then I'm on my way. If it doesn't, I just spend 3 hours looking at the blank sheet.
William Stafford said that. He said he would start with what would nudge his poem would be like a word.
Yes.
The Aztec word for blue is, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't even know the end of the sentence.
I never know. I never, ever know where a poem's going to end. Now, Robert Frost said, and I really liked it, he was so concise in his criticism. He said, no discovery in the writer, no discovery in the reader. And I take that as meaning that, you know, if the writer knows where you're going before you've gotten there, then the poem's dead in the water. So I like beginning with an image and not knowing where the image is going to go, or a rhythmical line that will give you the next rhythmical line, and hopefully the poem finds its way down the page.
Do it again.
Okay.
Len Roberts.
This is, I said earlier that I have people in my poems. I always have, and I'm pretty sure I always will. I can't write a nature poem to save my life. And many of the poems I've written are for my father, for my son, for people I love. This is one of those poems. This poem is called The List of Most Difficult Words. Now, I went to a Catholic grade school. I went to a Catholic high school, Catholic college, so it's ingrained. And those nuns really worked you over in good ways, in good ways. They're tough, but they're good. One of the ways that this nun, well, this poem is about a spelling bee. Remember the spelling bees, you know, when we were kids? But she'd always line up the boys on one side and the girls on the other and make it a real competition. And the girls were always better than the boys. But anyway, this poem is about my father helping me to prepare for a spelling bee. Now, a side note about this that's very important to me is that I had two brothers, there were three of us, and of the three, I was the only one my father concentrated on.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, my father went to eighth grade and dropped out. My mother went to seventh grade and dropped out. And neither of my two brothers ever got out of high school, and I had my doctorate. So I think what my father did for me was to aim me, was to give me my direction that young. So it's kind of fascinating. This poem is for him, and it's thanking him. It's called The List of Most Difficult Words. I was still standing, although Gabriella Wells and Sylvia Ryan were too, their bodies dark against that wall of light, that dull pewter December afternoon. Shadows with words that flowed so easily from their mouths, fluorescent and grievous, pie-eyed, effervescent. Words I had spelled out to the rhythm of my father's hoarse whispers during our nightly practice sessions beneath the dim bulb. Superfluous, excelsior, desultory, exaggeration. Mixed with his Schaefer's breath and Lucky Strike smoke, as I went down the list of most difficult words with a man whose wife had left, one son grown into madness, the other into death, my father's 105-pound skeleton of skin glowing in the beer-flooded kitchen when he'd lift a harmonica to blow a few long, sad riffs of country into a song while he waited for me to hit the single L of spiraling, the silent I of receipt. The two of us working words hard those nights on Olmsted Street, sure they would someday save me.
Lynn Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. What I get from reading your work through the years is a forgiveness for your father, what you call love. You have one poem, I think, about the goldfinch, where his heart is only as big as a bird's heart.
Mm-hmm. An ounce, fraction of an ounce.
A fraction of an ounce. And I spent 30 years suffering through my struggle with my father and my poetry. And after that, all of the good things he did started bubbling to the surface.
Yes, yes.
And I'm watching this complete metamorphosis in your work toward a recognition and a gratitude to your father. And what I love about poetry is that it is, we are not indifferent. That's the only way I can put it. It is a fight against indifference. If there's anything I'm afraid of in this world, it's indifference. And your poetry is just the opposite of that. Tell me something about your father and your poems.
Oh, well, this is, it's an astounding fact of my life. You know, I never wrote a poem until I was 28. And my father had died when I was 21. And I missed him incredibly. He was an alcoholic, and he did things that he shouldn't have done. But he was also a very loving man, and as the last poem showed, he really worked with me. For some reason, he guided me. But when I was 28, I found myself in Pennsylvania. I had just gotten my doctorate, but I had also just gotten my first divorce, and I was feeling pretty, really down, for the first time in my life, I think, really down. And I needed to talk to him. And I was in this old German farmhouse that I had remodeled, and I felt really silly talking aloud to him, so I wrote him notes. Now, this might sound very strange, but I wrote my father, my first writings, creative writings, were notes to him, long, I thought they were prose. I brought him into my office mate at the college, and he said, you know, this could be a poem, and he showed me how to work them, and they became my first poems. So it was communication with my father that made my very first poems, and I'm still writing. I think my strongest poems still are about my father and my son.
When did he die?
He died in 1969.
This is very interesting to me. He started as your mentor in a spelling bee,
yes.
And he continues to be your guide.
Yes.
I know you don't like the invisible as much as I do, Leonard.
I'm more comfortable with it. I'm getting more
is,
and more comfortable with it. He's with me.
He is with you.
Yes, he is.
And sometimes you write things that he might wince about a little bit, but he keeps saying, go ahead, think about that silent eye.
One of the sadnesses is that I wish that he could have seen what he helped to plant. Because he never even saw me get out of college.
And he does. Here we are different again. Len Roberts is going to read some more to us.
Now, I don't just write about my father and my son. I also write about, as talking on a telephone show, I like to talk about high school sweethearts. And this poem is called Passing the Orange, and it's about a game that we used to play when we were in high school. A semi-serious game. You know, you put the orange under your chin, and you line up boy, girl, and the game is to pass the orange from the girl to the boy, and then the boy to the girl. Now, I was at a party with my John Dumas, a friend of mine, brought his girlfriend, lovely Lorraine. She was gorgeous. I hope you still are, Lorraine, if you can hear this. And I stepped between them at this party. I got next to Lorraine to pass the orange, and this poem is about that. By the end of the night, I had lost a friend, John, but I had gained Lorraine. Passing the orange. I stepped between John Dumas and lovely Lorraine when the orange was handed out at the beginning of the line in some friend's house whose name I can't bring back. Just Lorraine's big breasts clear under that green Angora sweater. Just John's drooped mouth when she collected that orange so close to her throat I could feel her pulse as I wrapped one arm around her waist and pulled her snug so the orange would not drop but be caught between our chests where I could shimmy down to hook my jutting chin around its cool smoothness and inch by inch bring it up again, until my eyes were level with her lips, the gold sparkle on them glinting when we swayed, and I felt each breast give and give until that orange was mine. And she hung on the extra second just to see how firm a grip I really had, although the clock was ticking, and we knew this could be our very best time.
And this was a green angora this time.
Yeah, I just changed the colors. Actually, I changed the names.
That's
too,
one of my very favorites because it speaks to something, the innocence of what we did when we were young compared to what people pass under their chins now.
Yes. Yeah. And to me... And
but yet it seemed very lascivious. It was at the time.
Oh, yes. My girlfriend definitely thought so. She started in on me right after that. But at this, and I say this with hesitation. It's hard to say you've had a moment of illumination with a straight face. It's hard to do that unless you've had a few beers and you're in a bar with some good friends. But this was one of my first moments of illumination at this because I looked at the other line and I realized they were all truly trying to pass that orange to win the game. And I just realized that winning the game was not really the important point here. The important point was to enjoy collecting that orange under your throat and always teaching us process.
I want to mention your translations because that's something I really don't know too much about. The Hungarian poet that you feature is Sándor Csuri.
Yes, Sándor Csuri.
And how many books have you done of his work?
I've got one full book of translations published by Copper Canyon, 92. And I've got two chapbooks published in the 90s, just of his work. And then Boa Editions just took a manuscript of my translations of his poems. And that'll be coming out in 2004.
You just sent it across the transom?
Yes. I've been translating his poems and getting them published in magazines since 1993 or 94. They have not been book form. So last year I decided to put them onto a manuscript and see if anyone would want them. And Boa wrote back, and they're very happy. And fortunately, Boa is being funded by the Lannan Foundation. So the Lannan Foundation is passing on $10,000, $5,000 to Sándor Csuri.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, because in Hungary, that'll be a year's salary.
That's great.
And then $5,000 to me.
Do you take the flat English? How do you do that?
I paraphrase. I read the...
Can you read Hungarian?
I can read it. I can paraphrase it. But I don't trust... I was a Fulbright scholar to Hungary in 88 and 89 for a year and a half. And then I went back as a Fulbright translator in 91, 92 for half a year to work on translations.
You look at the poem. Take us from the process. Okay. Pass the orange. You take the poem, and it's in Hungarian.
Right.
And then what do you do?
I read through his manuscripts, and I paraphrase the poems that I think will be interesting, linguistically or according to the content or whatever. God knows why. It's all subjective, but I pick poems that I think would work that seem interesting to me. Then I make a loose paraphrase, and then I have two literal draft translators. I don't trust my language anymore, so I have two literal draft translators in Hungary, and I email them, and I say I want a word-for-word and a line-for-line translation of these poems, so I get both their versions, which are usually radically different. It's very strange how word-for-word can mean so many different things. And then I go to work with the three versions I have, and I synthesize. I use the Hungarian-English dictionary a lot, and it's like a giant crossword puzzle. And then once I get what I think is a workable line-by-line rendition, then I have to work on the music so it works as a poem in English.
Sounds like fun.
It's fun. It's hard work. Well, it's very hard work, but it is fun, and I love doing it, and it's been successful.
It reminds me of Pinsky translating Dante metrically, like an engineer does it. It's like in love with the difficult.
Yes, or Seamus Heaney doing Beowulf in the Old English, which is an incredible translation, just doing those four lines.
But it's the love of doing something difficult that fires you to continue.
Well, not many people know this, but Hungary is known as the Ireland of the East because it's really a country of poets, which is why I wanted to go there to teach. Per capita, it has, they're I'll give you an example. Chandrachori's book in 88, when it came out, this is what impressed me about him. There were 10,000 copies printed, and they sold out the first day in the small country of Hungary.
But 10,000. Isn't that more about the sensibility of the people?
It is, but it's also about their love of poetry. You know, I mean, Chori and I read. He read in Hungarian, and I read in English at the embassy in Budapest in 89. And we literally had over 1,000 people come in suits and dresses because, you know, poetry reading was an event. It was an event. I don't know if it still is, but my friends in Hungary tell me that year by year, that sensibility is eroding, but I hope it doesn't.
That's very interesting. Besides that, you have been busy doing other work. Here's some of the awards. A Guggenheim, 2 NEA awards, 6 Pennsylvania Council on the Arts awards, and a Witter Binner. And your fourth book, Black Wings, was selected by Sharon Olds for the National Poetry Series. Your poetry has been in the Best American Poetry and Pushcart Prize. And Len has been a visiting professor of creative writing at Muhlenberg, Lafayette, and in the Graduate School of Writing at the University of Pittsburgh. He lives with his wife, Nancy, and he has 3 children, right?
Correct.
Okay, so let's go on. Okay. More, farther and further.
Talking about children, talking about moments of illumination. I've had maybe 3 or 4 in my life.
Wow.
That's all, just 3 or 4. You know, and I studied American Romanticism for my graduate work. So, I mean, I believe in this, but it just doesn't occur that often. But one of them occurred when I was watching my son Joshua when he was 2 years old. My wife, when I met her, Nancy, had 2 children from a previous marriage, Bradford and Tammy. And that was fine. There were 6 and 2 at the time. So I've raised them as my own, and I love them. They are my children. But then a few years later, when I wanted to have our child, I said to Nancy, I said, well, you know, let's have a child. She said, what are you talking about? I said, you know, have a child. And she said, well, we have 2. I said, right, but, you know. And her point was that if we were going to have a child, I was going to watch him half the time. And I thought, because I was teaching, I had the time. And I thought, well, I've been in the service. I played high school and college football. I could do this, right? It is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Truly, this is not hyperbole. This is not poetic. It was hard. So anyway, he tired me out. But one day, I mean, he taught me a lot too. One day when we were walking out the back door to get some wood for the fire, for the stove, I watched him and he walked instead of, you know, as adults, we tend to walk from the back door to the wood pile and then back. A to B, that rut of conformity that Thoreau talks about, we walk those paths until we are conformist. And I watched him at 2, and he went to the left, and he went to the right, and he came back, and then he was all over the field. And I thought, that's wonderful. And then, you know, I had a moment of illumination. I realized that in order to really see things, I have to stop walking from A to B. And I've tried to carry that lesson with me for the last 20 years. So this poem is called The Moment, because there was a moment when this thought struck me. And it's from my son Joshua Leonard Roberts. The Moment. Walking the 3 tiers in first light, out here so my 2-year-old son won't wake the house, I watch him pull and strip ragweed, chicory, yarrow, so many other weeds and small flowers I don't know the names for. Him saying, big and mine and Joshua, words, words, words. Then it is the moment, that split second when he takes my hand, gives it a tug, and I feel his entire body weight, his whole heart weight, pulling me toward the gleaming flowers and weeds he loves. That moment, which is eternal and is gone in a second, when he yanks me out of myself, like some sleeper from his dead dream sleep, into the blues and whites and yellows I must bend down to see clearly, into the faultless flesh of his soft hands, into his new brown eyes, the miracle of him and of the earth itself, where he lives among the glitterings and takes me.
Len Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Let's go on.
Okay. You know, I wasn't sure I was going to read this poem. It's a short one, but it's a light poem. And I'm not sure it has that moment that we've been talking about, that, but it's a happy poem. One day, when Nancy was pregnant with Josh, we were up in Cape Cod vacationing. I looked out the window, and she was naked in the sand dunes. I mean, we had some privacy. She wasn't just on the beach, but she had the big belly, and she's just leaping up and down in the sand. I thought, well, I've got to write a poem about that. So here's a light one. It's called Pregnant, She Dances. The storm had stopped, leaving the ocean calm, the roses dripping near where you stripped off the white blouse and white shorts to stand completely white in the knee-high grass. Arms held over your head, you danced beneath oranges, beneath clouds. Not knowing, I watched from the window, your feet kicking sand ankle high, your pregnant belly floating out, stretching your skin like a bubble in batter, the roundness of it rising and rising, as though each leap created the child more fully, as though each sudden escape from the earth gave it more life.
When you write a poem, who do you write that poem to?
I never have anyone in mind. Like, as I said earlier, you know, I start with an image or a line, but as a poem starts working its way out of my gut, I realize that I am focusing on one person.
Who?
Well, it's Nancy, or it's Joshua, or it's lovely Lorraine, or it's, you know, I've talked to Dee Snodgrass a lot about this, because, you know, he began the confessional movement and all that, but when we talk about, well, is my poetry confessional because it's speaking with an I, you know, from the first person? And I don't believe it is, because my poems may start with a first person, I'm watching, but the poems are completely about the he or the she. They're out there. And that, to me, is what makes them objective, not subjective.
Oh, yes. Point of view is what makes them focused and gives us clarity.
Right. So the emphasis isn't on my heart, isn't on my sorrow.
It's what you see.
Right. And the emotion that I bear toward this person and the emotion that this person creates in the world, which to me is the gift.
That is.
I think.
That is a good explanation. Billy Collins says he always imagines a reader across the breakfast table as he's writing.
He does.
Yes.
And he speaks to the reader.
Yes,
now,
he does.
I can't do that. I've tried writing poems with the second person, you, the reader. He's wonderful at it. I can write to one person, but I can't write to the reader the way he does.
Here's something interesting. You and I both write about family a lot.
Yes.
And many contemporary writers do. I was reading recently that only since World War II is this kind of poetry prevalent. No one, and you studied the Romantic era.
Yes.
We never had Milton talking about his grandmother. We never had Tennyson. We never had any of the Romantics. Mm-hmm. So this is truly a modern phenomenon. And I think it's linked to the fact that as we evolve, we value and cherish more than we did. I mean, after all, in the 16th century, children were little adults in the 17th century and the 18th century. And really, modern times is more about valuing.
That and the fact, I think, that we've been given permission. In reading poetry, you know, poetry usually has its boundaries. It usually has its traditions. I think Wordsworth was the first poet to give us permission to write from this I from the perspective, you know, when he writes about his childhood, when he writes about going off into nature and becoming one with nature, I think he started to give us permission. And I think in the 20th century, the great adventuresome poets, such as Robert Lowell. I mean, you know, when people want to criticize Lowell, they'll say he's a confessional poet. You read his poetry, and he makes, this is the point, I think. I think we've been given permission, and in the 20th century, you're absolutely right. I think we are without values, and so we're trying to establish values on a more personal level. I think when most things lose meaning, then you're thrown back on the self. And the self then has to throw out its own filaments, as Whitman says. And some of my filaments are my family and how I relate to them, or my loved ones and how I really relate to them. So the self then makes its own meaning. I think that when I write a poem about the I in relationship to my wife, it's very personal, but the more personal it becomes, the more universal it becomes.
Because
I just assume that everyone who's out there listening has someone that they love.
You have to assume that.
Yes. I mean, we're all part of a human community, and when I write from the humanness within me, Galway Kinnell said that at one conference. I overheard him say that the more personal your poem becomes, the more universal it can become.
But across the board, everything that we know as writers, we have to know that everybody else reading it knows as much as we do. I mean, you have to have faith that everyone has felt what you felt,
yes,
knows as much, or else why, you know, why bother? We're
yes,
not in a silver cocoon.
But that is a wonderful feeling, too, because that means that we are in a brotherhood and sisterhood, that we are all one.
Maybe we are, but, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are causing mischief in the human spirit. And
yes.
I think at this time in history, I believe the poet and the poem is more important than ever before, because I feel we have to hold on to something that can remain permanent, and that is the voice. Everything else seems to be, in, there are worms in your computer, and there are bombs on the airplane,
yes,
and
yes,
there is yes, fear yes. in the subway.
It's chaos.
But if in that chaos, if the voice is like a silver thread that goes from one of us to the other.
Well, you know what, Frost, again, I love, you know, Frost did not write much criticism, but what he wrote, I mean, he's so concise. What he says is that the poem is a momentary stay against confusion.
Perfect.
And, you know, it is. It's like, or what Eliot says in The Wasteland, shall I at least shore my ruin, shore up these fragments against my ruin. And I think that's what we're doing. We're taking something and we're saying this is a permanent value. This poem stops time. It stops the chaos. This is what we can go back to.
Len Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and I would not want to be anywhere else.
Okay. Now, this is a first kiss poem. When I first started writing, I didn't know you couldn't write about first kisses. So I wrote this as an exercise and sent it off, and it won a little contest.
What was the little contest?
The Randall Jarrell Poetry
Ooh,
Prize.
Ooh, that's yeah. no little.
Yeah, it was nice. It was, and I was just beginning, so it's a short, simplistic poem, but I like it. It's called First Kiss. When that blue-black cloud came over the sandlot with raindrops big as marbles, we ran down the storm-white alley into Big John's orchard, where we leaned, then clutched the other shivering body, and I had my first kiss. But what I remember most is the running, how the wet clothes hung to our skin, how those clouds billowed up and lightning struck the hill, and the smell of cut grass getting wet, the sense of chill coming, the wanting to go home and the wanting never to leave. The two of us who barely liked each other, breathing, holding hands, the way we'd hold an apple slick with rain or a slingshot stone about to explode, about to soar away.
So significant a moment.
I remember it as clearly as breakfast this morning, more clearly. I mean, those clouds came. It was one of those summer thunderstorm days, the blue-black clouds came and raindrops. And truly, I mean, I remember all of that much more than I remember the kiss.
But if you can get back there, That's the safest place there is. And I believe for writers, whether it's in a crawl space under the steps or in your bedroom or in the treehouse, if you can literally get back there, you know, it is a place without stress.
You know.
Because time is stress. If you can get out of time. And I think every writer can really go back and smell that smell.
You
feel
know,
that way. It is so true.
It is true. It is. It's just amazing. Well, you know, Proust starts off with the smell of, what is it, Madeleine and tea. It starts the entire novel, remembers the things past. This is a little aside, but Carl Jung, the great 20th century psychologist, disciple of Freud, he's got this great theory that you know, when we come in our daily lives, we come across a series of mini crises, right? And one of the things he says that we do automatically is that consciously or unconsciously, we go back to moments in the past that have crystallized.
If we are lucky.
You're right, exactly. And I think artists do it more than regular people because that's what we do. We try to go back to those moments, we try to understand them. But by going back to those moments, it gives us that security, that strength, so we can come back up to the present and deal with the mini crisis or the major crisis. And I think that's what I do quite often in my poems.
And we want to hear some more of those.
Let me read a poem that's current. I'm 56, and my wife is younger than me.
Yeah,
I'm not going to. She's younger than I am, but she's getting older also. And of course, one of the things that you think of as you grow older and you start getting some illnesses here or there is mortality. And this poem is about that. It uses one line from Matthew's gospel. It's a beautiful line. Matthew said, "The lamp of the body is the eye." You know, and the idea of the light coming from the eye struck me. So when I wrote this poem, I used it. It's called April Dusk, and it's for Nancy. Though pewter light on the pond, fringed with the green shadows of trees across the road. The sky, one big pewter cloud, it's hard to look straight into. All that glare that says there's more light up there than we can bear. Which makes me remember Matthew's, "The lamp of the body is the eye." Even as I feel my eyes burning, spring allergies I had thought, the pollen and dust, the long days of sun holding on, 1 minute more than another until it's 8 o'clock. My wife and I still out on the patio with a little talk as the darkness filters in, taking the spruce and the fir and the hemlock, then the barn, then part of her face turned up toward the hill, then her shoulder, her arm, my leg, my foot, bit by bit, until we're nothing but voices. And most of the time, not even that.
Lynn Roberts, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. I love the cubism.
You know, I was just sitting there, and the darkness came, and it took the trees in the shadow, and it took the barn in the shadows. And it started taking her, and then it started taking me, and I thought, that's how it is.
How did you remember Matthew?
I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't
because
know.
You are such a renegade that you claim that you are a secularist. That's what you claim. But
yeah,
I claim that you are a deeply religious and spiritual being. We know you're spiritual, but... And I just think all of those hundreds of years of Catholicism are in your veins. I heard you do a marvelous lecture, Struggling with God, I think it was called,
yes,
or Fighting
yes.
with God, or
Struggling.
Arguing. All three things you do. And it was a disclaimer which was full of complete holiness. It was just a very holy lecture.
This poem, okay, a little background. I didn't speak until I was 4 or 5. And when I did finally start speaking, I had a terrible lisp. So when I got to elementary school, this one teacher took me aside for 3 years, the first 3 years of elementary school, and I had to, upstate New York, I had to go to school an hour early each day. And she would put marbles in my mouth and put me on the auditorium stage and have me read from the children's Bible for an hour, for 3 years, every morning, until I could say the words distinctly. And she, of course, I mean, you know, I'd still have a lisp if it wasn't for her. Now when I get tired, I still lisp. But this poem is for her. It's called Correcting the Lisp. With four marbles in my mouth, I began with thou shalt not. Reading for 3 years the Ten Commandments until I got the words perfect. The wish of W, the K of K. Sister Ann Zita standing for the daily hour in the auditorium's dark, listening to a lisp so bad she could not understand a word I said. The belt a mumble, the pad held before my face. Boy looking up at a smile to my right, a frown to my left, masks I'd learn later in life that people put on during plays. Father mask of rage, mother mask of blood. My lips forming beneath the repeating mask for the black-winged nun who clicked beads and murmured prayers while I went on and on. Thou shalt not, teaching me sin, teaching me how to say it. It's a dark poem she did.
Why, though, is it a dark poem? I mean, look what she did every day. Look how tortured you were. I mean, it must have been, you must have hated getting up on that stage every day.
I'm amazed I didn't choke to death.
Well, actually, when you think of it, I never thought of that.
Imagine.
Marbles in your mouth.
Yes.
Oh, gee.
I mean, she could. In these days of legal pursuit, she'd never be able to do that.
But it worked.
It did work. And
everybody,
I never knew that
everyone
later.
In your life, Len, has been assisting you. Everything brought into your life has furthered you one more inch. Now, how do you explain that?
Angels.
Matthew.
D.H. Lawrence says, great short little poem. Someone's knocking on the door, knocking on the door. It's the three angels. Let them in. Let them in. Isn't that a great line? I mean, that's... I've been blessed.
Says it all.
I've been blessed.
How do you get teachers to want to do this from their deepest selves? I mean, I had a student 35 years ago who didn't show up for a tutorial at Antioch College where I was teaching, and he came to my door this week. He said, I came for my tutorial 35 years later.
Well, you know... As an established and wonderfully known teacher yourself, Grace, that you can't really teach anybody anything. You can show them ways to get what they want to learn. You can help them along the way. You can drop guidelines, but they do the work themselves. So what I try to do, and most of the time it doesn't work, but what I try to do, I believe that memory is the muse. Mm. Memory is the mother of poetry. So one of the first exercises I do with teachers when I'm teaching them writing workshops is I ask them to go back to memory that stayed with them for a number of years. And then and going back to Carl Jung, he calls it clustering, you know. If you get one good memory, then it will have a series of images, and you bring up those images. And the only reason the memory stayed with you is because it's somehow significant. And I believe... And I may very well be wrong, but I believe that if you bring up the right memory with the right images, then that will give you the rhythmical energy for the poem. In other words, music is not abstract. The rhythm of the poem is not abstract. I believe that it comes from the emotional core of the poem. And if it's an angry memory, that poem's rhythm is going to have that rolling tide, that wave motion. Now, again, I could be wrong, and if it's a quiet memory, it's going to have the serenity. So anyway, what I try to do is help people to get in writing workshops to what they really want to write about, and then show them how to bring up their images. Once they have their images, try to find one line and let them go.
And the teachers then convey that? You think they take that into the class?
I've had some really nice successes with teachers who... You know, we all have. I mean, you're a wonderful teacher, Michael Glazer. There's so many people out there trying to do this. And I've had teachers write and say, I've used your exercise mm-hmm. with 20 students and it's worked. And then they've used it with 20 students and it's worked. And it just, God knows where that ends.
You feel good?
I feel really good. Mm-hmm. Feel really. You do
Is
too,
that
right?
Your specialty? I mean, yes, it surely refuels the body.
Yeah, spreading the word.
Is that your specialty, do you think, in teaching?
It's my vocation.
Okay. We have time for a couple of others. Let's have about
two more
poems. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to end. This is the second last poem. It's called Knots, and it's a poem for my father and my son. Now, my son, I need a little preparation here. My son likes to climb. And one of the places I'd bring him to climb was called Cathedral Rock. So it's an old church that was converted to a climbing center. So there he is climbing on his rocks, and he's climbing up toward these stained glass saints. So with my Catholic background, I thought, this is a poem for me. When I started writing the poem, my father came in. Because my father used to tie knots, and he taught me how to tie knots. So, okay, knots. I'm trying to remember the knots. Figure eight, bowline, Beckett Bend, my favorite. I'm trying to see again my father's brown hands in the mirror as they twined the Duke of Windsor knot until it was done, and I was off to the Paternoster and the hereafter. Down Olmsted Street, then Ontario, past Boney's Bar, where he had practiced the sheep shank and Fisherman's Bend, where he had made the long splice between two ends of frayed rope that night my mother high-heeled out. That's what I'm thinking as my son ascends the climbing wall of Cathedral Rock, stained glass saints still lifting their staffs and rods, their cupped worlds and glinting swords, while my son stretches carefully for whatever hold, hands powdered and taped, 12 years old, and still checking my figure eight before he slid into the harness, checking my safety knot before he rose, not believing I had learned them all in my father's smoke, not hearing the names as I repeated them, refusing to follow the leader up and down, down, then up again until it was done and he was safely tied in and ready to ascend. Like my old man, no doubt, face down on that smooth, cool walnut bar where he had fallen asleep and finally ceased to exist, the knots coming undone with his every breath, until my father was nothing but miles of rope and a pair of knowing hands that are my hands, letting out and bringing in my boy at the other end of a rope that's knotted right, cinched, taut, and holding the weight.
Oh, Len. Let us have one poem now
okay.
to remember you by.
Thank you. This is The Silent Singer. In
title poem.
The title poem of the book. And when I was in grade school, I couldn't sing, still can't sing. And the nun told me to comb my hair, wear a shirt and tie, and to lip sync. To be seen, but not to be heard. The miracle of it all is that I did it, and people afterwards would come up and tell me how wonderful my singing was. So here's for the nuns, The Silent Singer. The girls sang better than the boys. Their voices reaching all the way to God. Sister Angelica insisted during those practice sessions. When I was told to mouth do re mi, but to go no higher. When I was told to stand in back and form a perfect O with my lips, although no word was ever to come out. The silent singer in the third grade class, during the Christmas pageant and Easter week, the birth and death of Christ lip-synced but unsung, while my relatives, friends, and parents praise my baritone, how low my voice was, balancing those higher, more childlike tones, my father said. Adding depth, my mother said. Thank God they had my huskiness to bring all that tinniness to earth, my great aunt whispered. So I believed for many years in miracles myself, the words I had never sung, reaching their ears in the perfect pitch, the perfect tone, while the others stuttered in their all too human voices to praise the Lord.
The voice of Len Roberts.
Thank you.
This program is made possible by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.